From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. And we're talking about a disturbing documentary that tells the history of lynching in this country. The filmmaker Jacqueline Olive explores the nature of lynching, not just the brutality of it, but how it attracted average people to come and watch. It's also about how lynching is not a relic of the past. It's called Always in Season. We'll be right back.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jacqueline Olive's documentary premiering at Sundance this year explores the brutal stories of lynching in this country. The ones from decades ago, but also the ones from today. Because if you thought lynching was a thing of the past, Olive's film is a reminder that while the details of these murders may have changed, there are things about the nature of lynching that haven't really changed at all. The trauma and the shame and the way communities come together to hide facts and protect the killers and resist, talking openly about what happened and why. Jacqueline Olive is a documentary filmmaker, but she doesn't try and distance herself emotionally from this history of lynching. In fact, it's one of the themes in the film, really, how confronting the brutality of it may be the only way to understand how this happened and why it continues to happen. Her film is called Always in Season. Jacqueline Olive directed, wrote, produced the film. She's joining us here from the studios of community radio station KPCW in Park City. Her film is screening tonight in Salt Lake City, later in the week in Park City. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. And Jacqueline Olive, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
I wanted to begin, I want to go back. When did you first start thinking in a serious way about lynching in the sense of why it works and how? I mean, when did you first start thinking about all of this?
Yeah, well, you can see from the photographs in the film, the lynching photographs and postcards from a collection called Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America, that they are captivating, they are disturbing, but they also drew me in to want to know more about the victims. Looking at their faces made me realize that they could be some of my family members or the people that I knew. You can look at the faces of, for example, Frank Embry, who is a victim of lynching, who was photographed before, during, and after the lynching.
Yeah.
And he is paraded around on the back of in the bed of a truck naked as he's being beaten and stabbed, and yet he's still looking directly into the camera, challenging us to pay attention and to learn more about his story. And so that's what drew me in. And then as I started to look at the photographs, I started to want to know more about the spectators and the perpetrators as well.
So you started, like, what's going on with the victims? And then you're like, wait, who would show up to a thing like this?
That's
who
are
they? Is that right?
That's right. And it took me, you know, I had a lot of the notions that a lot of people have around lynching. You think generally, most people think about the victims as just anonymous black men hanging. And I'm from Mississippi, where lynching terror was pervasive.
Yeah.
Mississippi had the largest number of lynchings in the country. And I still did not really pay close attention to who the victims were. And so as I started to open up and understand who they were, and then probably about 6 months into research, I researched the film for 2 years before I started filming.
Huh.
So it took me about 6 months before I started to realize, oh, right, these people, the spectators and the perpetrators of lynching, they could be my neighbors. They could be my classmates, my friends.
You, as you say, you spent a lot of time researching it before you actually started production. What were you thinking you wanted to do? I'm interested in how that compares with what you ended up with, how you were imagining the film in those early days.
Sure. Well, I made the film over a decade, so
yeah.
The beginning looks very different from the end of the film. And that's really a great thing, right? Because as I researched and started to understand, I went from looking at the stories of the victims and the perpetrators and looking at it from a historical standpoint, I started to learn that some of the relatives of the victims were participating in the 2005 Senate apology for lynching. It was really the first national acknowledgement of this history, and it was an apology because the Senate refused more than 200 bills over generations, refused to pass anti-lynching bills. And so that was the first time in 2005 that they decided to confront confront the injustice of that. And so I started to learn more about family members who were living. And as I started to reach out to relatives, I then learned that people were very organically on a grassroots level in communities across the country. A few then in 2008, 2009 were tackling, doing the best that they can to figure out what they could do for justice and reconciliation and confronting the history.
Mm. You said that when you look at those photos, when you've looked at them in the past, when you, as difficult as it can be, you try to sort of channel the emotions that are coming from it to get a better understanding.
Absolutely.
So I'm interested as a filmmaker, as I mentioned in the introduction. So you're supposed to be this sort of dispassionate, you know, journalist as a documentary filmmaker, but how do you avoid not becoming emotionally invested in it, especially when you have a kind of interest in it in some ways in the first place?
Yeah, well, I'm African American. Yeah. I'm from the South. So I have a very clear sense and a very intimate sense of the history. But I'm a journalist. I started out working for an NBC affiliate before I started moving into documentaries. I felt like 60 to 90 second news stories just weren't enough, and I wanted to learn how to tell more in depth stories. And so I approach my work as a professional, and so that means that when I'm a director, I'm looking at a lot of things at once. I'm figuring out what's going on with the crew, what's going on with the people that I'm filming with. I'm thinking about my interview questions and their responses, and so there are many things going on with me at once, which is really important to me because I love filmmaking. And so I have that lens on. And there are times when I, despite having that lens on, that I'm emotionally impacted by what I'm seeing. The reenactments are very intense in the first year that I experienced them. I didn't know what to expect. And so there is this coming in and out of the emotion of the material. There are times when I looked at those lynching photographs, which you see in the film, and I looked at them for how they might be incorporated into a scene in terms of composition and lighting. Those same photographs, I could look at that way for weeks or for months, and then one day it would hit me. Wow. And really, really devastate me, the way that the victims were stripped of their humanity. And so, you know, it's back and forth, but it's been really important work for me, and it's really important for me personally to process all the information that I learned. The scope of the terrorism, lynchings happened over a period of time where Black people were dehumanized in so many ways. There was a continuum of tactics to maintain white supremacy, and lynching was the ultimate tool of terrorism. Yeah. And so it was really important for me to tell this story.
There's a story that runs through the film, which we'll get to as we go along here. It's the death of Lennon Lacy, teenager, 17-year-old, found hanging on a swing set in Bladenboro, North Carolina in 2014. And we'll, as I said, we'll talk more about that in a moment, but your son is Lennon's age.
Yeah.
You've talked about how your personal life and your work on this story in some ways converged with that. Would you talk about that? Do you mind?
Absolutely. So earlier I said I'm a journalist. I'm also an artist. And so I am primarily a filmmaker. And when you're creating art, you create it from everything. You create it from aspects of your being that you're not even aware of at the time. And so there's no way for my personal life not to intersect with my work. And I think it's actually a really healthy thing. It's a good thing. That means that you're putting all of yourself into creating your work. And so I had been filming in communities for 5 years where people were dealing with historic lynchings. And so even when I was looking at historic lynchings, this film is not at all historic. It's very contemporary. Yeah. I was looking at what people were doing right now on the ground because they were still feeling the effects of the pain, anger, fear, guilt, and shame that are often passed on when these seminal events where half the town comes out to watch and then immediately there's denial and cover-up, when all of the energy and all those emotions aren't dealt with, when they're not unpacked, they're simply passed on, and they're passed on from generation to generation without being examined. And so I had been looking at what people were doing around this issue for about 5 years when I came across the story of Lennon Lacy. He was found hanging from a swing set in 2014. And I just could not imagine having a son who was also 17. I couldn't imagine how his mother, Claudia, could deal with that kind of trauma. And I reached out and talked with her and Pierre, Lennon's older brother. And the more that I heard, the more striking the similarities were between what I had already been learning in communities where they were dealing with historic lynching.
Tell me about Bladenboro. What's it like? It's kind of a character in the film in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I moved to North Carolina to be closer to filming shortly after. And so I had been there for 4 or 5 years. And Bladenboro is a town of 1,700 people. Not only is it small for in the scope of small towns, but it's also very geographically isolated. So as you exit the highway to go to Bladenboro, you still have another hour to drive. And so like a lot of small towns across this country, not just in the South, people are moving day to day within the same power structures, within the same systems. But they are able to do it quietly because they're under the radar and people aren't really paying close attention to what's going on and often in these small towns. And so I got the sense of that with Bladenboro. I knew the minute when I was in Bladenboro because my cell service went out as soon as I arrived.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting we hear from some of the white residents there. A local newspaper editor, reporter, someone who volunteers at the museum. And it's interesting. It's not explicitly expressed, but you do get a sense that they don't want to talk about this, that they see it as a thing of the past. It's a kind of interestingly subtle when you talk to the white people in that community versus the African Americans in that community.
Yeah, and it's purposely subtle in the film.
Yeah.
I wanted people to understand what it feels like to live in the contradictions and all the layers in that community, that you have people who are warm and friendly. You see a lot of interracial relationships. You see people relating romantically and on friendship levels and professionally together. And at the same time, you see the power systems, the systemic racism that looks like segregation in that community, for example, and looks like a lot of things all at the same time. And so it's really important. It was important for me that viewers feel what that feels like to be in the area. And, you know, you had interviewed white people who said that there was no problem. There were no racial divisions there. Well, I think it is extremely it's galling that they don't understand that the measure. How would they know? Right. Why would they know what are the depths of the racial divisions that are in that community? They might have a sense of it if they're aware. But to assume that they have the bead on that when they're not African-American, when they're not people of color, means that they don't feel they're not compelled to understand more the dynamics that are going on in that community.
There's a moment early on in the film when Lennon's brother, you mentioned Pierre, talks about going home to see his family after he got the news that Lennon was dead. And we should say authorities at that point were insisting that he hadn't been killed, in fact, that he had committed suicide. And his brother Pierre, here in this moment from the film, talks about how he just doesn't believe it.
When I walked in the house, I saw my mom. I'm like, how? How did this happen? You know? And she couldn't even really look at me because she was so hurt. And it had, you know, I didn't take nothing personal. It just hurt me to know that she was that hurt. And I couldn't imagine what was going on through her mind when she had to go out there and see him like that. And then they tell her she don't know what she talking about. He did this to himself. And you're going to force feed a lie to my whole entire family and make us think we're crazy. It looked like honestly, it looked like it was a display, like it was a message. Like it was a back in the day lynching. Like that's how it made me feel. That's how it made me feel.
What does he mean when he says message? Because this is an important part of the film. The nature of it was that these were about messages.
Absolutely. So I'll backtrack a bit and just remind people that that academicians have found that there have been nearly 5,000 lynchings in the U.S. and overwhelmingly African Americans. African Americans were lynched with unparalleled brutality, often tortured, beaten, and photographed before they were killed for hours. With thousands of people watching in Waco, Texas in 1916, 15,000 white men, women, and children came out to watch the victim being lynched. And so there is a level of brutality that's really unparalleled. And so so Pierre's comment about the
display nature of it.
That's right. About the threat. Mm-hmm. Is that often when a lynching was over, after people had photographed themselves and taken parts of the body for souvenirs, the body would then be moved to the black community and left there for days as a threat. And it was as a way to get black people to police themselves. And so I filmed in other communities that don't show up in the film. One of them was in Lawrence, South Carolina, where there was a piece of rope left in that community, in the black community. It hung there for at least 50 years. There were shreds of that rope there, reminding people of the violence and what had happened. And the other thing about that scene is that Pierre speaks about, you have this devastating trauma of someone having murdered their family member. And those are individuals who murder their family members. But when a system colludes to make to compound the injury by making it seem as if it was the victim's fault, or if you somehow don't have a sense of the trauma and tragedy because they're denying what happened, because they decide within 3 days or 4 days to call it a suicide because it's more convenient, because it gets less press in the community, then it just compounds the tragedy. And so it's devastating. You can see it's devastating to Pierre and his family and the people in the community that loved Lennon.
I want to play another moment from the film. This is Sherilyn Ifill with the NAACP. And we hear her throughout the film sort of explaining the kind of historic context. And in this particular moment, she describes what she calls the character of a lynching. Here's another moment from the film.
And lynchings very often involve hangings, very often involved shooting, but also burning, including burning alive of victims. But it really was the character of the murder that made it a lynching. Those who were involved in the lynching perceived themselves as having the right to do this. And that's why it's most often done openly and notoriously, with the participation of average people. Not just to punish the individual person, but as a symbol, as a sign to the larger community, both the white community and the black community. Lynching was a message crime. Sometimes they happened in the woods, but most often they happened in places where the body would be seen, sometimes in a crowd of 10 or 15,000 spectators. And it's the public nature of lynching that really condemns the white community, because the idea that people didn't know, they did know. They did know.
What was so interesting, I think, about the film was that on one hand you have this historic conversation about something that had happened in the past. And we see these images from, you know, the 1940s, the 1930s, those kinds of things. But I think the thing that's so relevant about the conversation is that, as we were talking about earlier, the nature of this, in some ways, those things haven't really changed. And that seems to be one of the important messages in the film.
Absolutely. There are so many connections between what's happened historically around lynching and what's going on today around racial violence. And it's really important that we start to connect those dots and not just assume that the past has been walled off and it's something really distant from ourselves. The systems in which that really made lynching possible, the systems of policing, the legal system, all of the things that meant that someone, people, a community could go out and dehumanize someone in this way, all of those systems that then lynching also helped to prop up on the power structure it helped to maintain, they still exist. They've only evolved because we've never really unpacked this history. Mm. And until we do, we can't make the changes that we need towards equality. And if we're really about a racial justice, and I know a lot of people are very committed to work around racial justice, it's really important that we understand this history so that we do our work better.
Jacqueline Olive is with us. She directed, wrote, and produced the film Always in Season, which is part of the U.S. documentary competition at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The film is screening tonight at 9:45 at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. It's also showing tomorrow and again on Saturday in Park City. We'll have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a brief break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, what if lynching isn't a thing of the past? In 2014, an African-American teenager, Lennon Lacey, was found hanging from a swing set in Bladenboro, North Carolina. The police ruled it a suicide, but his mother and others say Lennon was lynched. The filmmaker Jacqueline Olive tells Lennon's story in her film, which is an examination of the present but also the past of lynching. It's called Always in Season. She's joining us today to talk about it. We'll give you details about some of the screenings here at the Sundance Film Festival of that documentary a little bit later on the program. You could have told so many stories of victims of the past, of lynching. Let's talk about one in particular, Claude Neal. Why did you choose this one in particular?
Yeah, it's a good question. Those sections, I call them the Claude Neal sections. They're layered on the film, kind of like a scrim.
Yeah.
Idea is that they really give you that footage. I try to do this throughout the entire film, but that footage in particular gives you a visceral sense of the terrorism of lynching. I cut in abstract footage, symbolic footage. That gives you a sense of what's going on, but it's not literal. Mm. It's coupled with documentation from lynching. And from the very beginning, I knew that I'd like to have someone read documentation from historic lynchings, like the invitation to the Claude Neal lynching that Danny Glover reads and the other documents. So you have those things coupled with Danny Glover's amazing voice and amazing delivery that really gives you a sense of the terror. And one of the reasons why those sections in particular were laid in is because I didn't want people to get comfortable. Mm-hmm. There's a point at which you start to hear about Lennon's story and you think that you're good and you understand it. And then you start to hear about the lynching reenactments and you think that you understand that. But I wanted to give people the experience that I had when I was researching, is that the more I thought I knew and the more heinous these incidents became, the more clear that they became to the extent of the terror, the extent of the brutality, the more surprised I was by how much I didn't know and how much worse it was. And so I really wanted to convey that. I didn't want people to be settled in the main stories, mm-hmm. but to really grip them again with the devastating terror of lynching.
I mean, I, like you, I thought I knew everything about how horrible these things could be. And let me play this moment. You referred to this reading from by Danny Glover. I mean, if it it couldn't get more horrifying than the fact that they were inviting people to this. Here's a moment from the film.
At sundown, the Negro will be taken to the farm 2 miles from here where Miss Lola Kennedy, the murder victim, lived. There, he will be mutilated by the girl's father. Then, he will be brought to the pig pen and murdered where the girl's body was found. Finally, his body will be brought to the county seat 9 miles from here and hung in the courthouse square for all to see. All white folks are invited to the party.
And then they sold photographs. But the fact that it was so premeditated, I guess there was a sense, I had the sense that that this was just this spontaneous eruption. But the fact that they, that this had been planned out. And also, members of the NAACP in Florida sent the governor a telegram telling him that this was going to happen. And nothing stopped it.
Yeah, there are myths about lynching that really I was really committed to dispelling. And one of the things is people think that they were these kind of very spur of the moment occasions where generally there were backwards people, maybe hillbillies that carry them out, rednecks depending on what community you're in and what language you use around people. That really they're scapegoats. That's scapegoating language. Lynchings were perpetrated and viewed by ordinary people in communities, and some in the highest authority, and children who came out. And so it's just a wide range of people who participated in the violence. And so it's important that people understand that. And the documentation also serves as validation, because there's this conversation about, you know, what whose truth is more valid, this generational memory, which you see in around the lynching reenactments in Monroe. A lot of what they're reenacting comes out of oral histories that the one of the co-founders of the Moorsfort Bridge Memorial Committee, he did oral histories for years before they started doing the reenactments because he wanted the facts of the story. Often the journalists colluded in covering up. So there were cases where journalists would write in the newspaper for people not to talk about lynching. And that invitation, the Claude Neal invitation, the 1934 invitation, that was sent out on the radio, in newspapers, and by telegram. And I looked back to try to find the original newspaper articles, the original radio stories, and have not been able to find them yet. And I found articles in a similar time period, but somehow those are missing. So it speaks to the fact that there are institutions that colluded in lynching that really, as Sherrilyn Ifill says, they need to come clean. It's important to come clean, not just out of a sense of accusation, but out of a sense that there are changes that need to be made. There are ways that we need to evolve these systems that have really been inequitable and really oppressive to people of color, particularly African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, you referred to another one of these layers in the film that I wanted to ask you about. In 1946, two black couples were lynched by the Ku Klux Klan. This was in Monroe, Georgia, at the Moorsfort Bridge. Basically, that's where they were shot and killed brutally. One of the women was 7 months pregnant. And I have to say, of all the there was, starting in 2005, you mentioned they started reenacting this lynching. And just looking at the reenactments is really difficult to watch. It's incredibly difficult. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that because I think this is one of the things the film conveys. People in Monroe, they don't want to – some people, they don't want to hear about it. They don't – why do you have to go back and do this? It's difficult to watch as a viewer. It's a really visceral moment in the film. I just wanted to talk about this layer that you've added to the story.
Sure. The reenactor's presence there, dramatizing on the spot where the violence happened, This seminal racial terrorism disrupts the notion that we are a post-racial society.
Yeah.
And so people were very opposed to the reenactors coming there. And the people in the area were invited to participate and were not interested. And so the reenactors are largely out of Atlanta, which is about 40 miles from Monroe. And they come there to help people to understand what happened to the Dorseys and the Malcolms, the two couples who were lynched. Their main, the impact of it, the result of it, it can go any way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a perfect event. It's not a perfect way, a perfect strategy for looking at justice.
But that's what I liked about it.
I have to say,
it was organic. It was untidy. It was kind of clumsy at some moments, but it was so of the moment.
Absolutely, and it was the thing that was exciting for me. Actually, is that it was an organic expression of their desire to set the record straight about what happened, and also to get the country to pay attention, because again, they believe that some people are still living in that area, and even if they've died, there are family members who know what happened, and so they really want people to come forward about the case.
Gosh, we get to see these rehearsals of it, which is difficult to watch as well, but also seeing this remarkable woman, Cassandra Green, who's the director, trying to put this together, trying to get people to say things that are not easy to say, to do things, and reenact things that are incredibly difficult. Let me play a moment from the film. This is Cassandra Green. She's, again, the director of this reenactment.
I will be directing the Moores Ford Bridge lynching reenactment for my third year this year. I've been doing plays for about 10 or 11 years now. It was all because of social issues that I saw that needed to be addressed, that no one wanted to address, and those are the issues that I go for.
Fire!
Pow, 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 pow. No more moving. It wasn't just killing these people. It was overkill. They were shot so many times. Dorothy, being pregnant, didn't matter.
Pulls it up. Yep, got it. Got it, boss. Down.
The baby was taken out of her body. A baby. Out of a woman's body. Rather black, white. So we really push that part so that they know that this was some sick stuff.
I just think the reaction in the community to that, it was really difficult for people to see it. And it's interesting, we see the reaction of the people watching it too. So there's a lot of things that are really going on, and you see the trauma of just, I mean, this is a reenactment, but that experience seemed so powerful.
Yeah, so when you come to the scenes, without giving too much of the film away, when you come to the scenes of the reenactment, they are edited. And by the way, Don Bernier is the lead editor on the project. He's been amazing to work with, and is a co-writer on the film. We worked together so to make that scene as immersive as possible, so that you feel what it felt like for the victims who were driven into an ambush on that bridge, for them to be pulled out of the car, for them to be assaulted, and for them to be lynched, so that the viewers feel that. And it's important that the viewers feel that. One is because you can't make an effective film about lynching with the audience being comfortable constantly. And so there are points at which I was very deliberate about wanting the audience to feel a sense of the terror, wanting the audience to be challenged about what they think that they know, and so to feel uncomfortable, and then, you know, to really guide people along in a way so that they can recover, but never fully feeling like they're on top of it, because that was the condition, is that Bryan Stevenson speaks about it well, is that black people were always in peril, that there was never a moment where they could rest. There was never a sense of respite. It's really important for the audience to feel that as well.
I wanted to ask you about we get the perspective from some of the reenactors. I want to ask you about Paula Logan, because she's featured in it. What is it? What did they go through? This is an African American woman.
Yes.
We should point out, and she was playing
Mae Murray.
Mae Murray, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a little moment of her reacting, but let me play that first and you can talk a little bit about Paula.
You can feel it out here. You can feel the spirit of those that died out here when we came out and we did, you know, did just the rehearsal. Just since I've been here in this town, I see the way that they look at you and the this feeling of nobody should say anything. We don't want to talk. You know, let's not talk about this.
Yeah, she's, how was she affected by that experience?
Paula is, all of the reenactors are amateurs. And so that was the beautiful thing about it, is that they brought their own personal reasons for coming to play those roles, but also their ability, their acting ability. And Paula was and is probably the most effective, the actress who's had the most experience. And so that meant that she was really emotionally connected in that role with the victim, Mae Murray Dorsey. And it was really difficult for her. She says that she was so affected by it that she went to burn the clothes, because she didn't want any of that energy following her. And at the same time, as difficult as it is, she's done it multiple years in a row. And she does that because it gives her a sense of power that she's able to bring a type of closure to the family. And they are hopeful, and they were hopeful, that an FBI investigation could really bring some folks in that area to justice.
Yeah, I don't want to give too much away of some of the particulars on this. I wanted to ask you, it sort of comes back to something that the Cherilyn Ifill was talking about, that I think there's this perception that even though these lynchings were the result of some crime or some allegation of some crime or something brutal that had been perpetrated in some way by an African-American, and they just went overboard. One of the things that Cherilyn talks about is, in fact, that people were lynched for saying the wrong thing, for not stepping aside on sidewalks. I mean, the range of it is remarkable.
Even when people were lynched in relationship to a crime, often they were innocent of that crime. And often when the town has been spending hours and they're spent with all of the energy and excitement of having lynched the black victim, there's still a perpetrator in that town that has gone free. And so it speaks to the notion, the dehumanizing notion, that black people are immediately in their essence criminal. And so you see with police shootings, for example, you see black people being gunned down, particularly black men being gunned down, who are unarmed. And yet they are portrayed as the perpetrator. It would be almost as if they had killed themselves. So they are deemed criminals. And the effect of criminalizing a victim and then lynching them also then transfers to the family, because then the family has to live with those, with that stigma. And so there are just so many aspects in which this terror, this violence, reverberated throughout the community from generation to generation.
Here's another moment from the film, Cherilyn Ifill talking about how this process of dehumanization begins, as she puts it, with words.
Most black men were lynched because they were accused of having sexually assaulted a white woman for murder or some violent act committed usually against a white man. But sometimes it could just be having violated the rules of, you know, not having tipped one's hat or having left the side of the street when a white person was walking past. It could be being regarded as uppity. And it really involves a process of dehumanization, that the black man had to be physically restrained, that he was over-sexualized, that he was naturally and inherently violent, or something that's not human. And it's this very insidious process of dehumanization that begins always with words, that allows average individuals to stand and watch and to participate and sometimes cheer while another human being is brutally murdered.
Would you say a little bit more about what she means by it starts with words? Because that's such an important idea.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a climate of hatred. There was a climate of dehumanization in which lynching operated as a tool. And so when you have black people being dehumanized in ads, for example, in television ads, ads for products, when you have people being marginalized politically, legally, through segregation, all of those things then set the ground for people then to feel like it's okay that I come out. It makes sense for me to come out with my neighbors, to bring my children along to watch someone being tortured. Often victims were, there was a, when I began filming, there's a woman, Doria Johnson, whose great-grandfather was Anthony Crawford. He was a beloved patriarch in the family. He owned 430 acres of land. He had 13 children, built a home on his land for all 13 children. The people in that community decided that he was too wealthy, that he was too successful, that he was too confident, and they decided to steal his land and lynch him. Anthony Crawford was beaten, stabbed, lynched. He was hung, and then he was shot over 200 times. And so when you have this ideology that's dehumanizing, then it means that you can then do things that are so animalistic and think that you're okay. It's the same thing. You have semantics matter. So when you talk about people who immigrate into this country without documentation and you call them aliens, it's setting the groundwork that can very easily start to evolve and to degenerate into this kind of violence. So it's really important that we look at our behaviors and that we look at them through the lens of history. There are a lot of lessons about this history that we can use now.
I wanted to ask you about the story of Olivia Taylor, because what we see, you know, we were talking about Paula earlier, you know, if you're African-American and you're participating, that's one experience. But the fact that white reenactors were, you know, were willing to participate in this, I think is really interesting. See, I want to play a moment from her. Her story is remarkable. Tell us a little bit about, just generally, before we get to her particular story, the willingness that of some of these white reenactors to be part of this.
Sure. There were many beautiful people, one of which was Olivia that I filmed with. And Olivia had come to the reenactment because she had seen them and she realized that the wardrobe needed to be tweaked because she was very familiar with the Klansmen would wear because her father was head of the Klan in Stone Mountain, Georgia, and she grew up as a child of the KKK, as she words it. And so Olivia came to the reenactors, to the reenactment for that reason, but she ended up playing a role in the story. And she did that largely because she wanted to find a way to heal the guilt and the shame that she was carrying from her childhood, and also to help bring healing to the community.
She tells a story. I want to play a moment. She, as you said, her father was a member of the Klan. And when she was quite young, she witnessed a lynching.
And then some of the men arrived with the black man. The Klan had the man's hands bound. I could tell there was something wrong, but I didn't understand what until they hung him. And when I saw it happening, my mother reached around me and put her hand over my mouth and pulled me to her so that I wouldn't speak out loud. It was hard to believe that that was really my dad and his friends that I knew that ate fish and hush puppies at the house. But it was. It was the same people. I never knew any of the details except what I witnessed, and I was too afraid to ask. I never talked about it until Daddy died.
This is something that is an important theme in the film, that something has to alter the conversations we're having about race. And maybe it's that we have to get explicit about the things that we know, that we've seen, or that we we don't know about that we need to talk about. I mean, it seems like being able to confront these difficult things, even though it's really difficult, I mean, you can see that at every moment in the film. You know, people don't really want to sometimes. But this seems really crucial. Would you talk about that?
Absolutely. People often ask me, how can I work on a project that's this intense for over a decade? And that's a good question. I think a couple of things is, one is that there were people like Paula, like Cassandra Green, the lynching reenactment director, and Olivia, who were confronting this history, who were looking at it square in the face, and then doing something about it. And so that was always inspirational for me, particularly at a time when in 2010, when I began filming, there were very few people wanting to talk about lynching, African-American, white or otherwise. That was before Trayvon Martin was gunned down. That was before we started to have this national conversation about racial violence. And it was at a time, again, when there was this myth that we were in a post-racial society. That was the general story that was being told about this country. And so that people were confronting this history was deeply inspiring for me. And Olivia's story in particular, I was excited about. I'd filmed the reenactments over 3 years, and I had filmed the year previously, come back to get some more footage so that there's some consistency in the narrative, because from year to year, that might be one hit Klansman and then a different person playing that same character. And had set up to interview Olivia, only understanding that that her father had been in the Klan, and understanding that history, but not knowing that she had witnessed a lynching. And her story reminds us, one, is that these groups, these white supremacist groups, have evolved, and they're not that far in the past, even when we start to look at them historically. Olivia was, I believe, in her late 50s when I filmed with her, and she has this history, and she played with and lived with dozens of other children who had also come up in the same way. And even when you come from a family that did not have any organized connection to the Klan, there are still ways that we all can fall into the trap of moving through systemic racism, moving through all of the institutions that we navigate daily, like housing and banking and education in our schools. There are ways that we can help to prop up and maintain these systems when we're not paying attention.
Which I think it gets us back to Lennon Lacy. And I don't want to give too much away about that story. I think it just gets more and more complicated, and this is a complicated story. But Claudia, his mother, she's kind of a remarkable person, I think. She has this calmness to her that you wouldn't expect given what she's gone through. But this perspective, and she talks about how early on she says, you know, this town, this place, it's supposed to be an extension of your family. And she says, until this wound is healed, it's going to be an open wound. We have to find a way to heal it. And so she's not just looking for justice or one particular outcome. It seems like she wants to know the truth, whatever it might be. If, in fact, her son did kill himself or didn't, you know, whatever. But she wants to know what actually happened. She wants to set all of that aside.
Yeah, this film, I've never approached it as a whodunit. There was a point at which I was trying to figure out how I wanted to navigate the details of the evidence and the witnesses, and you can go down that rabbit hole. I decided not to do that because I wanted to reflect where the community is and where Claudia is, which is left without answers. And then left without answers because years after his death, evidence has it's just been erased. There was evidence that was not looked at. No one looked through his room. No one looked for a suicide note. He was found with someone else's shoes on. All of these inconsistencies in the evidence and this lack of a thorough investigation means that the community is left with stories, with rumors, with speculation. And it was really important for me to portray that. The other reason why a whodunit is really missing the point is because we could find out what happened to Lennon, and that would actually be a gift to the community and to the family. But that doesn't speak to the dozens of other cases similar to his. It doesn't speak to the systems that have come together to, one, make this violence acceptable and also to cover it up. And that's really, for me, the crux of the work that needs to be done. And it's the work that we're all capable of doing. You said earlier that it's a really difficult story. Much of it is really challenging. It can be extremely emotional. But one is that we're capable of handling deep emotion. And two, we're carrying it in our bodies anyway. When we stuff it down, we're still moving through these communities. We're either carrying it in our bodies or we have this cognitive dissonance that comes out of this historical cover-up. And it means what it looks like is that we don't see fully what's going on in our communities, what's going on around us. And then we're not able then to step up and do the work that we need to do.
Are we capable, do you think?
Yeah, we're more than capable. I've had to deal with the emotion of this over 10 years, over a decade. And the way that I do that is I make sure that I am confronting it, that I am facing it, that I am experiencing it. And it really has driven my work. It's made it possible that I can make a film that's so complicated. I've never wanted to make a simple one-off story, but I wanted to show that this is not just one story, that this is affects the entire country, and that it's a problem that's systemic. And so that's why this is really important that people understand the scope of the terrorism.
Well, Jacqueline Olive, congratulations, and thank you very
thank
much
you.
For joining us.
Yeah, absolutely.
The film is called Always in Season. The film is screening tonight at 9:45 at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. There are two more screenings this week in Park City. You can get details for all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Renee Bodley, Bob Hendricks, Scott Matthews of community radio station KPCW. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.